Today we discuss, is saving actually possible? Tim.
One of the things I noticed here recently when I was in Argentina is people like shopping. Much more than people like shopping than in, for example, Western Europe, Taiwan, or United States. And I think there's a rational economic reason for that in the sense that there's high inflation. So like if you get paid in paper money or virtual money through banks, which is effectively paper money in a sense, or virtual money, it'll be worth less. There's a space between the worth and the less tomorrow than it is today, let alone a year from now, considering there's like 20% inflation, depending on the time frame you calculate it. So you may as well buy that car, scooter, air conditioner, purse, hat, pants, or go out for dinner now than tomorrow. And Keynes himself likes to talk about the velocity of money. I sure want you to get into that later. This is more of your expertise. This will be my first question for you. But I'm just going to outline the topic more of how I got to this position of asking the question, is savings actually possible? And is saving desirable as well? Savings in terms of saving pieces of government money bills might be a dubious idea, especially if you're an Austro-libertarian of some variety or anarchist like the two of us. Recently there was a zero hedge debate on the future of the dollar. And I will say all four of them were non-economic leftists. The Clintons weren't there. The Bidens weren't there. These weren't Biden or Clinton supporters. They didn't like high taxes, and all four of them. So both the people arguing for the U.S. dollar and against the U.S. dollar. You know, Brent Lingle or Noam Chomsky or Ben Burgess were not there. Maybe they weren't perfect, the opponents of Murphy and Rickards were, but they weren't bad either. This wasn't like some sort of socialism versus capitalism debate. So one of the things that Murphy's opponents argue is that in the squeeze, the more traditional fiat currency, namely the dollar, but also the euro and pound, will do better relative to all other ones, such as the Argentinian peso, such as the Mexican peso, such as the Chinese currencies, such as the Russian rubles, and so on. So the argument for the opponents here is that the U.S. dollar will still be the global currency, and therefore, to some extent, the global savings instrument, if you're saving indeed in dollars. Argentinians, for example, as well as other countries, do some amount of savings in literal U.S. dollars, not just dollars in a bank, but dollar notes. And I've noticed this from other countries too, like Egypt, and even in parts of Asia, I think some people still do this too. Now they're saving literal currency notes, not just notes in a bank. So people, and I think we have to divest this from transactions. I think there's a slight difference between saving and transaction, but I think they're overlapping. But savings is more long-term in nature here. If you're spending something in the next few weeks or few months, that's what transaction is. If you're thinking about 10 years from now, that's more in the savings category. If you save in dollars, again, this is a continuum, so it's any point on the continuum, you could always sort of reductio ad absurdum itself to the other end of the continuum and say there's no difference between saving and transaction here. But if you save in dollars or any fiat state currency, or you're really just collecting IOU tickets, which are interchangeable, and you can pay your taxes to said state in. I mean, this is the MMT line. Bob Murphy has also debated an MMT, which is never a great debate, at least I thought it was. And I think somebody in the comment section made a question, is it really the Army and Navy what backs and the ability to pay taxes is what makes a fiat currency work? So fiat currency in some sense is an effective means to save in the sense of always the question of compared to what? Another way people save is in stocks. But I think for Austro-libertarians, you have to think about, as well as Marxists for that matter, you have to think about what kind of companies' stocks are you investing in? How are they backed? And like, you know, aren't they just more or less an extension of the very Federal Reserve System or the European or British examples as well? And so forth. So like, You know, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out that Boeing and Bay Systems and Airbus and GM and Fiat all have close ties with their existing states they're anchored in. Now, if you want to save in old, if you want to go full Old Testament and save up grain for 7 years in a silo, then I think you might be engaging in savings. But the problem with saving up grain in a silo is that is actually expensive. I think this is where, in a strange sense, we could circle back to Keynes here. Like, so if you're saving guns, if you're saving oil, now some things can't be saved. You can't really save beef. You can't really save milk. You can keep beef alive. You know, there's certain ways to do this. But you know, there's certain things you can't save for 30 years. So like, you know, what would be the ideal? Should savings have a return of investment? That's another question to ask. Gold and silver, I think, is another interesting method of savings. And that was a method that Murphy's opponents discussed in the zero hedge debate as being superior to fiat currency. Again, for transacting gold and silver, especially in the modern economy, but even in the historical economy, poses problems in the sense that you have to move the gold and silver around. The gold could get robbed and so forth. But as far as, I mean, you know, as a savings method, if you're saving it and you have a secure place to save it, then it's actually pretty good, in my opinion. And as the most austere libertarians would agree, I don't really disagree either. Now, I do think there's a difference between saving a gold fund with certificates versus saving the actual gold. But for now, I'm just going to table that distinction. Although I think people who really are paranoid should think about, you know, if you're just saving in a gold fund, what are you actually, are you doing anything different than the people saving in dollars or people saving in mega corporation stocks? And the last thing we could discuss is, well, it's two other things. Last thing is we discussed saving in land. Again, I will bring the example of Hans Hoppe's parents saved land, but it's not like the Soviets cared about their property rights. Now, you can say that's an existential risk, that's a tail risk, that's an extreme example, having your land expropriated by the Soviet Union. But as you see in the United States and Britain, there's eminent domain of some variety. There's also regulation, like how many can you actually farm this land? Can you single family zone it? All sorts of rules about what's your land to do. And if you can't mine the oil in the land or whatever, then your land doesn't have much use value to other people buying it. So it's not that good of a method of saving. Although in practice, in the United States at least, saving in real estate and property is generally a good idea. And it was actually Rod Dreher himself, sort of Christian reactionary of some variety, although he's terrible on COVID, who point out one of the problems of people can't buy homes is retirees use their homes as like a savings asset. And the last thing you could save in is Bitcoin or some sort of cryptocurrency. But there's a lot of critics of the Bitcoin here. They'll say it's a get-rich-quick scheme, uses too much energy and so forth. I'm not really interested in making this the Bitcoin podcast here. There's plenty of other areas to talk about this. Although I do think that as a savings instrument, Bitcoin, not as a transacting, because I think the transactions are expensive, but Bitcoin might rival gold in terms of savings if it sticks around, which I think it will. So Swithin, outside of saving in physical goods, can you actually save? And what would be the ideal savings in an ideal society, if you want to discuss that, and the velocity of money question. I'll throw all three questions I'm thinking in my mind right out, and you can take them at will as well as my comments. Thanks for doing this episode.
The argument you're saying about how you could save in physical goods like grain or something, I think that's an interesting point. I'll elaborate on a little bit. I think when you're saving, you're attempting to save some form of value. Now, what do I mean by value? Well, something that's going to provide value to you as you understand the term value. Now, with grain, the value of grain essentially comes in its use value. You could, in principle, preserve some food or something like that for a long time, as well as grain. And that would have use value too. So you can clearly, insofar as it's not stolen or it doesn't degrade, you can clearly sort of save and have value in that. Well, and similar things like munitions or weapons or some things to that degree. When you're thinking about, now your question largely is, well, what things can you save in which are going to maintain their exchange value? That's essentially the question. Because when you're saying, oh, you can save in gold, silver, etc., what was really meant by that is, yes, you can have that, and then you are confident that you can exchange this for goods and services you want to actually use. So primarily, the value comes in the exchange value rather than the use value. Then that brings us to the crypto question. Is crypto good for Bitcoin, good for exchanges, or just for holding its value? It's interesting you mentioned this. There was an interesting journal article, I believe it was Philip Baggus, I think, which had the title, The Quality of Money, which they said was an oft overlooked aspect of money because everyone was always considered the quantity of it rather than the quality of it. And I think it's in this one. He makes the case that to be a money, you need to have a store of value, must have a store of value. Otherwise, it wouldn't even be used to exchange at all, because if the value was rapidly reducing, nobody would accept it in exchange. And so it made the case really that the store of value, which really is what we're talking about here to some extent with savings, was actually more fundamental to a money than well, maybe not more fundamental in a certain sense, but it was a necessary condition for anything to become a money. Otherwise, it wouldn't become a general medium of exchange. So then the question is, well, what is going to be something good to save in? Well, it's going to be something that people will readily accept in exchanges. It's going to be something that's going to be it's going to be the most liquid form of savings. So in a sense, the things to save in are physical goods that maintain their value over time. But there don't really seem to be many of those, with the exception of precious metals. And as you mentioned with Hans Hopper, land, those would seem to be the things which hold their money, hold their exchange value over time. Now, they aren't necessarily that liquid. They might take some time to sell, but you probably would be able to sell them. Clearly, then, the ideal thing would be something that you could easily sell and would hold its value, by which effectively we're talking about here is, well, money, but a money that holds its value. And then, well, clearly then you'd be, well, historically you're looking at really gold, silver, copper, or in more modern terms, possibly crypto. Those would seem to hit the sweet spot of being valuable but also easily saleable, because the problem with land is land sales take quite a long time, especially in England at least. I mean, just for instance, now this isn't just land, but when I bought my house, it was the easiest possible sale. There was no chain. I was a first-time buyer, and the seller was going into a nursing home, so they didn't have to sell. Now, I suppose it could have been easier if I wasn't getting a mortgage, but that didn't really cause any issues at all. But from agreement of sale price to actually closure, it took like 2 months. Now, clearly, if you're going to want to convert your savings into goods and services you consume now, selling land is not a good idea. You raise the question, so then we're really sort of like, I think, gold and silver and crypto. I mean, maybe gemstones as well, possibly. But the problem with gemstones is that they're not divisible. And so you can't have a particularly well-diversified portfolio. When it comes to... So essentially, you're talking about crypto or gold. But as a pro sort of paper money advocate could say, well, the gold might actually reduce its value significantly depending on what the state will do with respect to sort of like taxes. And getting value from that, or preventing sales in gold, which of course is happened historically, or gold holding. So you could argue that that isn't always going to hold its value. And to that extent, crypto might be better. I suppose it's going to depend on the regulatory regime and how easy it is to hide, because crypto transactions, well, you can't hide them, but they're permissionless. Well, at least Bitcoin ones aren't. They're traceable, but they're not easily traceable necessarily. although I am no expert on the privacy aspects of crypto. So it would seem to be that the best things to save in were the precious metals and possibly also crypto.
The question I'd like, if I could just quick interrupt here, direct here, the question I'd like to ask you is with an is savings desirable, and what is this velocity of money argument? Because we just discussed savings and we more or less assumed it was a good thing. But not everyone thinks savings is a good thing. Plenty of people think savings, if pushed, they may not say this in the direct sense, would think savings is undesirable. What would be the economic reason why they think that, and why is that wrong? Also to ask that question, which I assume you think it is. I think savings is a good thing.
Oh, yes. So that makes sense. So the idea of the velocity of money is how quickly, say, a note or a coin or a money of some sort goes around the economy. Now, really, what you could argue is the higher the velocity of circulate, the velocity of money, the lower the demand for money. That is, people are willing to hold less money. And the argument goes, and that's probably a better way, I think that's a better way of looking at it than velocity, because velocity really treats the economy as some sort of mechanistic sort of physics system, which it's not. The argument is that depressions and recessions are caused by an increase, or at least in part, by an increase in the demand for money. And if you have an increase in the demand for money, velocity falls and amount of spending goes down. And so if you want to put this in Keynesian terms, that means aggregate demand falls and then this causes a recession and relates to that deflation. Now, and deflation. So then the question is, well, let's suppose that that's even true and does cause a recession. The increase in the demand for money. It doesn't follow from rephrase. Even if the recession is a result of the increase in the demand for money, it doesn't follow from that the increase in the demand for money and the decrease in velocity was bad, because that might be the best solution to the problem. And really getting into business cycle theory. So the classic Austrian position would be the misallocation takes through the boom. In the boom period, they have the recession, and then at that time, well, the normal thing happens there is there's loose monetary policy, prices go up, then the central bank then increases interest rates, then lots of people fail to pay back their loans, and then total spending falls. That's kind of bad. That's bad, but only insofar as it unveils the investments which were actually fundamentally unviable, or at least there was a significant disconnect between consumer preferences and what was actually produced, as was messed up by the loose monetary policy and the suppression of the interest rate by the central bank. So even if you say that, well, yeah, it is effectively caused by a decrease in quote unquote aggregate demand, which is kind of total spending on final goods and services. So goods and not intermediate goods, finished goods, and that's kind of a bad thing. Well, even if it is causes something bad, it doesn't mean that it's the worst solution, because, well, clearly you want people to, if people think that they're going to lose their jobs, for instance, it kind of makes sense that they're going to save. Now the Keynesian argument is, well, that's going to be bad. Because fundamentally, the Keynesian position is based on the idea of sticky wages. So if I was to say to my workers and say, hey, look, there's going to be deflation, that is an average decrease in prices by, say, 10%, and I'm paying you £10 an hour this year, for the coming year, I'm going to pay you £9 an hour, and actually that won't be a fall in your real wage by how much you can buy, because £10 last year will be able to buy the same as £9 can this year. Now, according to the Keynesians, no, they're never going to accept this, and there's going to be contracts that may oblige you to pay particular wages, and they won't be flexible downwards. And so when the sales receipts of the firms goes down, they're going to need to reduce their costs, and they won't be able to reduce their wage costs just by saying, hey, we'll just pay you less. they have to, well, the only way they'll be able to do it is to fire people. And then it causes increases in unemployment. And to a large extent, now there are other things as well that would stop wages going down, such as welfare payments and things like that. But it seems to me that this sort of wage stickiness argument is vastly overblown. And even if it did exist to a small extent, and as an aside, that would have been in the interest of both parties at the same time, because the firm would have been like, well, I'm willing to engage, sign a contract, say, a couple of years with a worker at a particular wage because I want to keep him. So the rigidities, quote unquote, aren't necessarily a bad thing insofar as far as they go. But this is easily solvable. I mean, you just say, I pay you £10 an hour, and, oh, if it ever happens to be deflation, I reduce your wage. So granted, there could be a transition period, but there's no reason why that isn't possible. In my mind, the association with savings and sort of deflation is really just a conflation of what really caused the bust to begin with, which wasn't actually per se a decrease in velocity or an increase in the demand for money. It was rather errors and malinvestments that took place because effectively the quality of money was bad. So that would be my response directly to the velocity argument. To many of the questions on my response to that before I move more on to savings in general.
What do you think would be the ideal rate of return for savings? Now, obviously, it depends on what we've discussed this in private, like in Austro-libertarian world, a stock market would be probably pretty boring, in contrary to what many people would think, as it would be kind of boring in the sense that it would not be a casino of a something, a variety. What do you think the return on savings ought to be? I mean, you've discussed the Georgists, for example, in the past about land and the Georgist position on land being, because people do save a lot in land, maybe not directly, but like they'll work at a job and then they'll either buy into, you know, some sort of land trust type fund of some variety, or they'll own the actual property as the housing example here. You know, houses just keep going up in prices. Now, some of that is quote unquote natural in the sense that if you live in a desirable area, say like outside of New York City, or say certain areas of the United States or certain areas of the world, if you live in a desirable area, there's positive fertility rates, or there's people moving in, prices will go up. Demand goes up. So that's more of like an investment than a savings, if you think about it. But it also has use value in the sense that you are using the land there. So what do you think should be the natural return on savings? Like the Keynes, again, to go back to the Keynesians and the MMTers for that matter, they like inflation because it defrauds savings. Now, they wouldn't admit that per se, although the MMTer in that debate did sort of, in a sense, admit that. With Bob Murphy, but like, you know, if you expand the money supply, you can build all this stuff. But it's sort of like alchemy in my mind, as Bob Murphy addressed it as alchemy very well. Going back to the question of savings, should it have a positive return on it? I mean, that I'll stop rambling. What would you say to those questions/comments?
Well, we need to define savings. Because the reason I say that, you might think, well, it's obvious what savings is. Well, the reason is a lot of people think, oh, you can save money in a bank. And you, in principle, could. If you gave them the money and you said, oh, look after it and make sure it's not stolen. And the bank goes, yeah, but what's in it for me? And then you would pay the bank to look after your money. That's what you could refer to as effectively plain saving. But when you put money into a bank and you get an interest rate and you get a return, you're not actually saving. You're actually lending to the bank, who then lends to somebody else. So you could then, so when you're saying, oh, what is should be the return on savings? I mean, really, in the sort of productive saving sense, you are, what you're saying is, well, what should be the return on lending, which sort of makes the question somewhat different. But if you'd gone plain savings, what should be the return on that? I mean, what we're really taking up there then is how much, if you were saving in a money, the question is, well, what's the ideal rate of inflation or deflation, effectively? Because if you want there to be a negative return for plain savings, which is the Keynesians do, because the Keynesians are concerned about increasing spending because of inflexible wages and costs, well, then you want a negative return on savings, so people spend it quickly to keep the spending level high. You could make the case, well, we want price stability, and therefore we want a zero return on savings, that is to have no increase or decrease in prices on average. Or you say we should be deflation, and you should be able to increase your return on savings. I think that there is no one ideal rate, because, again, everyone's inflation and deflation rates are different. But what I would say in general is, insofar as people want to hold, well, the one of the purposes of this is for the individuals in question is to hold value. So it at least needs to be zero. And you would want it to go up in value. I mean, that's what you would want to save in. And so an arbitrary amount, 2% a year, maybe something like that, of plain savings. Now, clearly, if you're going to pay someone to look after it, you have to pay them as well. But I mean, just imagine that it couldn't be stolen and they want any other costs. You know, how much would you want your savings to go up by? 2% a year seems an intuitively reasonable figure. It might be higher, it might be lower. You could though say, ah, well, but this is unproductive because you're withholding these resources from the market, which in a sense you are, but by not spending, you're increasing the purchasing power of other people who do spend. So in a way, you could argue that saving actually helps, as sort of quite, quote unquote, a positive externality of the people who are spending, because the people do spend quite a lot. The prices are kept relatively low. Why? Because someone has decided not to spend their resources. Now, you could argue, though, that this is different if you were saving in physical goods. For instance, say grain, you could say, oh, it's bad that you're not spending your grain because that means the grain price is higher than it otherwise would be. And then that would mean that people can't eat in the same way. But it's not immediately obvious that that translates the same if you have a commodity money which isn't intended to be consumed. And even if it was, that would seem more to be about having a monopoly over grain supply rather than, or having a situation whereby you control a significant proportion of grain supplies so that you can extract high prices from others. Imagine it was a barter economy of wine, bread, carts or something. That would seem more to be it rather than the saving of grain per se. So maybe you might want to make a case insofar as somebody had loads and loads of gold, for instance, and they were withholding it from the market, then this might be bad. But insofar as the gold isn't really used, I mean, the only real problem with that for consumers would be, oh, well, gold jewelry is more expensive. Oh, and heat reflectors for spaceships are more expensive. So when it comes to something that you hold primarily for exchange value rather than use value, and it's kind of like an inert good, I think the arguments you might use against holding things that you might want to consume like grain don't really hold in the same way. So my claim would be, yeah, you're going to want there to be an actual return, not only on lending, but also on plain saving, and probably around, I don't know, as I say, 2% seems intuitively reasonable. Also as well here, this would mean that people engaging in financial products, where people actually understood them. And you wouldn't have a situation whereby people put money into their banks and don't actually realize they're lent out. And then, oh no, they lose all their life savings. And then this encourages bailouts and subsidies and federal deposit insurance and things for households, because this guy in his 70s lost all his life savings, because the people who were actually engaging in the financial products would actually know what they were doing. And most people could go, you know what, I've got some savings. You know what we're going to do? I'm going to save it. They could save it in a vault or they could save it in a bank. Just on saving costs, I have some gold held by a company called Gold Money. So they claim that I own gold in a vault in London. Now, I don't know how easy it is for me to access, but it is in principle there, so they claim. They charge, I think, something like 0.12% to hold the gold there. Now, granted, it's just held there, and it's not engaging in any transactions. But imagine that you were to have a bank holding money, and they weren't to lend it out, and they were to provide you the payment services that they currently do. I can't imagine the bank would need to charge more than 0.5% a year on holding your money into an account, which would mean that if you were holding, let me get this right, £100,000 and $100,000 in the account, you would pay the bank only £500 a year to have that service, which kind of seems quite cheap. So if you have £100,000 worth of value there, and the prices could well be lower. So I think actually having a banking system whereby you do actually make a clear distinction between actual savings and actual lending to the bank is something that is entirely plausible, and you would still have all the payment benefits. Now, then you go commodities, you've got to move them, you could do certificates, so that could happen. And you have the problem of fraud and people not having proper accounting. But in principle, you know, you could just trade the certificates and have various amounts in denomination of actual coinage, which you could actually withdraw. I mean, that's possible. And insofar as people trust each other, you don't actually need to move it very often anyway. So I do think some like a commodity-based system on that kind of banking style is possible. I know that's maybe slightly moving away from what you're asking. But plain saving, I think 2%. But clearly remember, there's a difference between saving and lending to the bank, which is often conflated these days.
My final line of questioning here is in the savings of physical goods. So you talk about physical gold maybe being £500 for 100,000 or something like that. And I brought up the example of saving grain in the silo. I mean, one of the benefits of saving grain in the silo is you could say that farmer or whatever the organization doing it is actually doing a service. This is an argument for utility of this. That if they're waiting for higher prices, what they're really doing is they're waiting for a time in which the there's less grain available in theory. Now that might not be true in all circumstances here. But you could say that is the case. So savings in physical goods, though, seems to come with costs. So like to store a large amount of grain or to store a large amount of oil. So here in the United States and other countries have a similar system. The United States has this huge strategic petroleum reserve system. It's in theory designed to fight a war. That's in theory. It's like the last. It's to keep the it's fight a war. That's what I think its initial thing. It got filled in the Trump administration at like $1.50 U.S. gallon or one was what I forget the barrel rates, but it was really when gas was cheap. And this is one of the reasons Saudi Arabia wants to rack up the prices. They don't like the fact that but the Biden administration has been draining the strategic petroleum reserve to keep gas prices lower, all the while talking about climate change and other BS like that. But like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, in a sense, on a country level, is an example of saving physical goods for a rainy day. I think that's an extremely useful thing to do. Again, I'm not a fan of the U.S. wartime or whatever state, but I don't think that in principle is a bad idea. And if I have a critique of some of the Austro-libertarians, is they're not like the Bob Murphy's debate partner, is they're not paranoid enough. And a lot of things they talk about to save him, in a way, they're not as much different from the people across the table debating them. Obviously, they're different than from like Ben Burgess or Noam Chomsky or other or MSNBC types or CNN types. Obviously, they're different than them. But they're not paranoid enough. Do you think there's a utility to saving physical goods? Not merely like Well, they might have used, they have use value by definition, because you can't just save, like, sand. I mean, maybe there's a scenario in which sand has become scarce or something like that. But, like, saving physical goods that you could, in theory, use or other people use, because that's, like, we had a dunk, I think his name was Duncan on the Bitcoin episode, and that was one of the critiques I made at him, you know, is that, like, a lot of the scenarios that people attack Bitcoin with are also critiques of the current existing financial system. If the power goes out, that'll also be a problem for the whole SWIFT banking system, too, if the power goes out. It's not just a problem for Bitcoin. It's that would also be a problem. So, then, any thoughts on the savings of physical goods?
They do, clearly has a utility, and yes, they're probably the best things to save in the worst possible scenario, because people will more want physical food and raw materials for building or whatever, or munitions, than they might even want gold. So they may end up being more saleable. Although I suppose that's a very, that's sort of like your sort of post-apocalyptic scenario. But I mean, maybe not as harsh as that. You do have situations like that when you have hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, for instance. Physical goods are useful. And you are right to bring up the sort of Bob Murphy types may be too optimistic. One thing that made me more pro-crypto than I had previously been was the debanking and seizing of the assets of the Canadian truckers. Because, well, the banks, even more so than they were historically, seem just to be an arm of the state. So I say, well, crypto is good. Now, then you could say, well, yes, well, the problem is well, what if the electricity goes if you can't trade crypto, which is true. I suppose the question is, the problem is with crypto is, yes, what happens if the electricity goes off? I suppose then you get questions about battery power. And really as well, what would make crypto more indestructible would be if a very small, well, the easy thing is, imagine a world in which everybody owns their own nuclear microreactor. If that's the case, the probability the lights go off is essentially zero. Insofar as you can get the uranium or the thorium that you require to run the microreactor, and then you've got a massively resilient system. So I suppose what you could say is, if you really want to have the most stable, resilient financial payment system, what you really need to do is to have energy independence. And by energy independence, I don't mean as a country, I mean as an individual. You have a situation whereby you can actually have access to effectively, unlimited, but way more electricity generation you need. And then you're okay. Obviously, though, it breaks and can you fix it? That's another problem. So it depends how difficult we are to work. That's going to give you more independence. Now, I suppose the government could then we go to the whole scenario. It's like, yeah, but what if they ban them and then you get arrested and imprisoned for having microreactors in your property? Then we're effectively going on to state formation and effectively war again, which is, of course, always a problem, always a possibility. Whether crypto is more stable than, say, gold is going to depend on how easy it's going to be to maintain the power on. And actually, in today's society, even if you did have just gold transactions without any electricity, the division of labor is going to become significantly less vast, and trading is only going to exist on sort of like a citywide basis. In the main, obviously, you'll get traveling traders, but you're not going to get worldwide transactions in the way you currently do. Well, assuming that the electricity goes off. If electricity goes off, of course you could, but if it did go off, the extent to which trading could take place is going to be significantly curtailed. Does that answer your question?
Yes. I think this will basically be it for this episode. I do think savings is desirable. I don't think it's a surprise that the era where gold was dominant was an era where human ingenuity and industrialism of getting, again, I know there's sort of like paleo-Catholic, paleo-Protestant critiques of industrialization that exists and some primitivist critiques of industrialization exist. But I don't think it's a surprise that, like, you know, the era of industrialization happened in an area where it was, gold was more or less, maybe not the de facto current savings unit, but it was definitely there as a savings unit. And I if you look at the books like Tyler Cowen's Great Stagnation argue, the past 60 years, you know, since the fiat a la carte blanche, hasn't been as innovative as the previous years. Now, again, the previous years aren't perfect by no means. Don't confuse that me with arguing for the Garden of Eden before the fiat era and before 1914 either. So I do think having reliable savings is a good thing, because I think it promotes, you know, this goes back to the Hans Hoppe's brief history of society, so to speak. And as far as like the big owners, they have to be consumers too. So they can't just save everything. They have to be, they by definition have to consume to survive too at some point, at some level. So I think there is a utility in savings. And I also think there is a utility, if you're sufficiently paranoid, in saving in physical goods of some variety. Like if you think your money's going to be worth less with a space in it tomorrow, let alone 5 years from now, then maybe, you know, having 100 gallons of oil in a gasoline in a tank might be a good idea, or maybe even larger, or having some gold, or having some food. Again, this gets into quote-unquote prepping territory, which, you know, that there are arguments against. Again, this goes back to the, are people like Rickards and some of them, are they paranoid enough? And with that question, I think, you know, the future is uncertain in that regard. So whether U.S. dollars remains, which is the question of the debate, I think was answered, yes, the U.S. dollar is going to remain. But what the system around the U.S. dollar, that might change significantly here. But I don't think it's either a replacement here. So I think savings as a concluding mark has a utility. Maybe the Keynesians don't, but I think the Keynesians are wrong, as you effectively described. So with it, any final comments?
Just a couple things on the Keynesians to finish. I should possibly have mentioned earlier. The major innovation of Keynes was his complete segregation of production and consumption. When you look at Keynesian analysis, what you're looking at, you're always real output and spending. But the problem is, well, what are you actually spending? And this goes back to Keynes's misunderstanding of Jean-Baptiste Say. Say's law says that a supply constitutes a demand, the basic premise being that, well, the only thing you can buy something with is something you already own, because otherwise you've got nothing with which to demand it. Keynes bastardized this, and whether deliberately or otherwise, maybe we're setting a straw man, my knowledge of the intellectual history of Keynes is not good enough to be able to say whether or not it was deliberate or otherwise. He said that supply created its own demand. And then Keynes said, look at all these surpluses in recessions. Look, well, clearly supply doesn't create its own demand. But Say never said that. So you have this fundamental problem in the Keynesian thought, is you can treat spending in isolation from production, which simply makes zero sense. And that's why, oh, we need to get spending up. It's like, well, if you want more spending, you need more production. Otherwise, all you're doing is just, it's like saying, oh, we need, supposing the money with pineapples. Oh, we need to get more spending of pineapples. Oh, what we should do is, let's not produce more pineapples. Let's just produce more receipts of pineapples, and we'll trade those and we'll get more output. It's like, that makes no sense. Of course that won't happen. So the segregation of production and consumption makes zero sense. Although it kind of makes more sense in the context of a fiat money system where it is kind of segregated, but that just really highlights the oddity of having these sort of paper receipts, which effectively wouldn't otherwise have value unless they were legally privileged in certain ways. Now, of course, the legal privilege just provided value, that's true. But the idea that just producing effectively more receipts is going to increase the amount of production doesn't make any sense. Now, of course, the Keynesians will say, well, the more sophisticated Keynesian defender is, well, that's still true to some extent if we have quote unquote spare capacity, because we don't need to produce anymore. We just need to get that which exists to be brought into circulation. But I mean, to me, that you're ending with a semantic game of, well, what actually constitutes resources? Because this is like, there's some argument that, oh no, savings is bad because you're leaving resources idle. It's like, but they're doing something useful. So you're going to get into a debate of what constitutes useful uses of resources. One last thing, deflation. One of the classic arguments against deflation, because I said that savings should increase maybe by 2% a year by plain savings. They would go, no, but this is going to mean people are going to spend even less, because what they'll do is they'll realize, if I just keep my money for one more year, I can buy even more stuff. And it's like, well, it might. But if people did decide to spend that much less, then the amount that firms might increase production by is going to be lower. And if that was true, then the rate at which the rate of increase in the value of savings would actually go down, because the way in which under quote-unquote good deflation would take place is, supposing spending stays the same, but output increases and prices go down. But if firms thinking, well, actually it's not profitable to produce anymore, and they don't, well, then it's kind of a self-regulating system, because that'll just mean that, well, prices go higher. Production won't increase by as much, so the rate of deflation will fall, or maybe hit zero, or maybe is even, well, it probably wouldn't, well, it could be inflation, but it basically hit zero. And the thing is with the Keynesians, so it's a self-regulating system, so even if deflation was to get sort of too high, so too negative, there's a system to regulate that. And so what if the value of your savings goes up over time? People need to spend now. You don't just defer spending all the time. Now, even the more sophisticated defenders will go, well, you know, we're not saying that people are going to not buy food this week and wait for next week, but like durable goods like washing machines and stuff. And it's like, well, people, unless this argument only really makes sense if you have a consumer culture whereby you're always buying new stuff all the time that you buy because you just kind of like it, which kind of presupposes that's a good economic model to begin with. But a lot of things people buy because they need it. People don't just go about and buy a new car because they fancy it. Maybe some people do, but most people buy it because, well, their old one's breaking, or their circumstances change, so they need to buy something. Same with like a washing machine or a tumble dryer. People don't go, oh, you know, I've always really fancied a new tumble dryer. Like, no, that's highly unlikely. They'll do it because their needs have changed and they would have bought one anyway. And also another thing to say on this is, I could probably wait next year and get a better television than I could buy this year. Still doesn't mean I'm not going to buy one this year, even though an anticipated future increase in quality effectively acts the same as a decrease in price of a good of the same quality would. But no one would say that an increase in quality in next year is a bad thing. Well, they might. I mean, they could. They would be consistent in doing so, but it'd be a very, very strange and difficult position to defend. So that was just a final sort of defense of deflation on that. This is leaving aside debt deflation, which is one of the other arguments. But again, that's really as a function of the business cycle, and I don't want to go there. Tim, any final comments on what I brought up a few extra things. So just if you have any extra things to say that I haven't covered. Or
no,
wasn't clear.
No.
Excellent. That's fine. Brilliant. Well, I'd now just like to thank everyone for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your family and subscribe to us on Podbean on YouTube. The more subscribers we get, the higher we get in the search rankings, and the more people can access this material. And if you'd like to contact the show for any reason at all, please contact us at mindcryinglibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcryinglibertyshow@gmail.com.